Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. This is Ryan Tripp. I've returned to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm here today with Professor Douglas R. Edgerton. We're going to be discussing his recently published book out this year by Basic Books, Heirs of an Honored Name, The Decline of the Adams Family and the Rise of Modern America. He is professor of history at Lemoyne College. Welcome to the show, Professor Edgerton.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So let's just get to it. What prompted you to study how and why John and Abigail Adams's grandchildren and great-grandchildren witnessed, and according to you, frequently orchestrated, their families' decline and fall?
Well, the book was a somewhat of a departure for me. My earlier writing, this is my eighth solo book, and most of my writings have been about race in early America and slave rebelliousness. But every book I write tends to lead to the next. And so my last book, which was called Thunder at the Gates, about the three black pioneering regiments in Massachusetts, the 54th, the 55th, and 5th Cavalry, I covered 14 soldiers, 10 black soldiers, 4 white officers, and one of the white officers was Charles Francis Adams Jr., the grandson of John Quincy. Well, I found to be a fascinating person. And like many of the Adamses, he's fascinating because he's on the right side of history. He volunteered to lead a black cavalry regiment, the first, in fact, ever black cavalry regiment in the U.S. But was so dislikable. He once was writing to his brother Henry, and he says, nothing tells like being contemptuous. And he seems to kind of live his life by that nexus. Just kind of surly, unhappy person in general. And so again, he was just one of 14 people I followed in the last book. And I thought, you know, these people, they really deserve their own story. And it's because they do reach the presidency. John and John Quincy get all the attention. And the last few years, two big biographies of John Quincy and good friends of mine recently published a great book on the presidencies of John and John Quincy. But nothing on the third and fourth generation. Henry, of course, remains fairly famous because of his writings, his novels, his works of history. But Charles Francis Sr. has been somewhat forgotten. He pops up in diplomatic histories of the Civil War because, of course, he's Lincoln's ambassador for 7 years to Great Britain. But certainly they don't get the kind of attention that the earlier Adamses do. And so I thought, you know, here's another story that just has not really been told that deserves to be told.
So what circumstances culminated in Charles Francis Adams, who is the grandson to John and Abigail Adams, becoming the quote-unquote last of his generation? Please discuss his childhood in Russia and France with his parents, his difficulties at Harvard, his courtship of Abby Brooks, the suicide of his brother, George, and the alcoholism that contributed to the death of his brother, John Jr.
Well, he's the third son. And of course, for an Adams, the first son is always the one who goes on to be the next statesman, the next president, Adams. And so he has two older brothers by his parents, John Quincy and Louisa. George Washington Adams, named, of course, for the former president. And by the way, that raised eyebrows in the Adams household because you name the oldest child after the father. And so when John Quincy decided to name his oldest son, George, after the late president. Both John and Abigail were fairly put out. So then the second boy became John Adams II. So Charles Francis comes along, 6 years younger than his oldest brother. And in 1809, John Quincy, who had been a Federalist, but he'd been literally thrown out of the party for endorsing the Louisiana Purchase, was tapped by incoming President James Madison to be the first ever American minister. And then we today call him ambassador, but at the time they're called ministers, to Russia. And so Grandma Abigail simply announces the oldest boys will stay with her and Quincy, and that John Quincy could take the youngest child, who's only four at the time, and go to Russia. So he's raised essentially as an only child, and he's raised in Europe between 1809 to 1817. But first Russia, then he's actually in Paris during Bonaparte's 100 days when he returns to power, and then finally for 2 years in London, where John Quincy becomes the second Adams to be the minister to Great Britain. So he has this amazing childhood, and here he is talking to the Tsar Alexander, traveling all around Europe. He sees Bonaparte speaking as a child. And gets the full of attention of his parents. And then he has a sister, Louisa Catherine, who's born in Russia, and she dies at the age of one. And at that point, he and his mother, Louisa, become very, very close. But the sad part of this kind of family dynamic is that as a boy, Charles Francis describes his father, John Quincy, as being cold and unfeeling. And then his son, Charles Francis Jr., later on describes him as being cold and unfeeling. So this kind of distant parental dynamic that the Adams men can't seem to break. But he has all this time to be the only child. His father tutors him at home, and that's actually a fairly funny story. He's doing 5 hours a day, and again, Charles Francis is five at the time. He's just a boy. So John Quincy is grilling him Latin, German, French. And they take him to the court, and the Tsar makes a mistake of saying, "What a bright child." And so at that point, John Quincy decides that Charles Francis is a genius, and then piles on more language and geometry and, you know, 6-7 hours a day. And finally, even Abigail writes back from Massachusetts and says, "You know, John, maybe kind of pull back on this a little bit." And as a child, Charles Francis discovers he could irritate his father by willfully mispronouncing words that he's learning in French or whatever language, Russian. John Quincy writes in his diary, he's doing this on purpose. He's mispronouncing the words just to annoy me. So he does have this, you know, just amazing childhood, which is why then he goes back to London as like his ambassador. He's uniquely prepared. Abroad, and at one point actually goes to visit the house that he lived in London when he was a boy with his parents, now as an adult with his own children. So he has, in a time in which most Americans don't leave the state of their birth or maybe move one state west. For a boy who's been all over Europe, he comes back and prepares to study at Harvard. And, he just has a childhood like nobody else, a preparation for foreign service like nobody else.
So what were, in turn, the dynamics of Charles Francis's children, especially Louisa, Charles Francis Jr., and John Quincy Jr. and Henry? And how did Charles Francis come to engage with the anti-slavery movement prior to the death of his father, John Quincy Adams? In your response, please try to address at least three of the following. The Prigg decision, the first Massachusetts personal liberty law, the repeal of a miscegenation law, his support for a resolution to overturn the Three-Fifths Clause, his 4th of July oration, and or the consequences of his daily Whig editorials.
Sure. Well, in the late 1830s, and there's a real ambivalence in the third and fourth generations about do they want to pursue national greatness. They have money enough, and all the Adams men marry into some cash, and so they don't have to pursue the kind of law cases that most people pursue. He has his hobbies. He loves to loves to collect ancient coins, Roman coins. He's got this kind of sort of low-level law practice, but of course he's an Adams. And one way to think about this is the Adamses at the time are not the first American political dynasty. They're the only political dynasty. Of all the early American presidents, only John Adams and Martin Van Buren have sons adulthood. And so every time there's an opening for, dog catcher in Massachusetts, some editor will always say, well, it's got to be an Adams. So just kind of putting around the house, is not going to be okay. And Charles Francis Sr. Marries Abigail Brown Brooks, and that comes with a lot of money. Her father's a shipping magnate. She's one of three daughters, and all the daughters get a huge dowry to buy a house with. One of his brother-in-laws is Edward Everett, the Secretary of State. And so he buys with his wife's house money on Beacon Hill, a house on Beacon Hill. And Parton just wants to just stay there and do that. But again, the pressure from society, the pressure from his father, who's still alive until 1848, is enormous. And so he's approached in 1839 to run for the State House. And again, as an Adams, if he says yes, it's a done deal. And he declines. And Dad, John Quincy, who's now back in Congress in Washington, writes him and says, we don't turn this sort of thing down. You're an Adams. You must do this. And so the following year, he does agree to run, and he serves. In those days, it's a one-year term in the State House. So he serves three terms in the State House and then two terms in the State Senate. And that's where you see his early anti-slavery progressivism, but also progressivism that is, I don't want to say tainted, it's probably the wrong word, but laden with pragmatic concerns, legalistic concerns. And so there's two things he really wants to address as a state assemblyman, and first is fugitive slave trade, which is a fugitive slave law, pardon me, which is really heating up. And so to go back, 1793, Congress passes the first ever Fugitive Slave Act based on the Constitution. Article 4, Section 2 makes it very clear that if you are, doesn't use the term slave, it says held in labor. If you are held in labor in one state, escaping into another, you are not free, they can bring you back. So a slave catcher named Prigg is arrested in Pennsylvania. And the question then goes to the highest court in the land. Is the Fugitive Slave Act constitutional? And of course it is. I mean, again, there it is in the Constitution. So the court upholds the law, and petitions come flooding into the state assembly. And of course, the William Lloyd Garrison point of view, and he's in Boston at the time, is that moral people must disobey immoral laws. So the hardcore abolitionist position is, I don't care what the court said. We simply are not going to obey this law. And if a fugitive arrives at our door, we'll protect that person. We'll help them get across the border into Canada. We simply will not obey this decision. And so as an Adams, as an attorney, third generation attorney, he needs to find what he thinks is kind of a decent middle ground. And so he writes a state law that does pass. That holds, yes, he concedes the point that the law is, in fact, constitutional. But he says only the federal law has been upheld. And so, therefore, state officials, mayors, governors, whatever, are not only not obligated to carry out the law, but, in fact, they are banned from carrying out the law. So essentially, if you are a local sheriff and a fugitive slave goes running right by you, you are in fact compelled to do exactly nothing. He goes on to say, even if a slave is captured by a federal marshal and you have a local jail, your jail may not be used. So it's a very legalistic, very smart position, but legalistic in that it doesn't kind of really take into concern the humanity of a a Harriet Tubman. Frederick Douglass, who's in fact a runaway. So Adams always tries to find for his entire life this kind of common ground, this legal ground between the desires of white Southerners who simply want their expensive property returned, no questions asked, and then evangelicals, Garrisonians in the North who argue that going back to the earliest moments of Christianity, that a Christian man does not obey immoral law. So Adams always tries to find the middle and typically does. And of course, states had been passing what were called personal liberty laws, which allowed for some small modicum of defense for people being accused of being runaways. I should point out here that a runaway under the law, this 1793 law, the more draconian 1850 law, they're not accused of any crime. They simply are errant chattel, like a cow that has wandered off the plantation. So in theory, when someone is accused of being a runaway slave in Boston, they're not supposed to be accorded any kind of protection, any kind of attorney. So legalistically, Adams always does want to have, some kind of protection for runaways. And so, certainly one should admire him for that. The other thing he does, which is really interesting, but again, tells you a lot about his kind of middle ground point of view is that there's a series of cases in the 1780s that collapsed slavery in Massachusetts. It had never been really important anyway. At the time of the Revolution, Massachusetts was only 4% black and enslaved. And most slaves in Massachusetts, like Crispus Attucks, were urbanites, dock workers, mariners. So slavery collapses thanks to two interlocking court cases back during the Revolutionary era. But at the same time, in 1786, the state passes a law banning intermarriage between whites, Native Americans, and African Americans. And Adams regards that as, he calls it, the last vestige of slavery in Massachusetts. So he's determined to eradicate this law. And at the time, it's a real hot potato. It's like same-sex marriage was 20 years ago. No one wants to go near it politically. And he does. And he's a Whig. Neither the Whigs nor the Democrats in the state will kind of go near this. He spends 3 years putting this coalition together. And 1 year it passes the House, and the next year fails in the Senate, and vice versa. So finally, 1843, he gets it passed by a pretty close vote of 142 to 126. And he writes that night in his diary, "Today I killed the last vestige of slavery in Massachusetts." And then he says, "Although nothing can be more disagreeable to me than the consideration of the subject which it involves." So in other words, he wants to kill the law because he regards it as a bad law. And again, one can admire him for this. He wants all Americans to be equal under the law. But the idea of blacks and whites actually getting married, he finds morally repugnant, to the point that he says that in his diary. And so for Adams, and this is kind of the first inkling that he and his sons all turn against Reconstruction in the years after the Civil War. For them, it's always about legality. It's never about humanity. And when he says, "I hope it doesn't happen," well, of course it's happening. He just doesn't know any black dock workers in Massachusetts or runaway slaves or Irish immigrant women who are inclined to marry black dock workers. So for him, it's always about legal theory, never about the actual people involved. And so for me, this was kind of the first hint that you know, after the Civil War, when so-called radical Republicans, who are frankly not all that radical, are kind of pushing the Constitution to make it a bit more expansive, and Adams pushes back and says, you know, it's what it was in 1861, it doesn't change. It's never about the people. He never mentions in his diary, for example, in the years after the Civil War, tens of thousands of black activists are being brutalized, assassinated, removed. It's always, well, what about the Constitution and the law? So you see this here as a young man. So, you know, again, this was the kind of balance problem I had in writing about all these Adamses. They're on the right side of history. He spent years putting together this coalition to kill a bad racist law. But then the idea of people actually doing it, he finds repugnant.
So what ultimately prompted Charles Francis to help formulate the Free Soil Party platform as a vice presidential candidate, and then he joined the Republican Party? Also, what happened to Charles Francis Jr., John Quincy Jr., and Henry at Harvard? I know they met Rooney Lee, Robert E. Lee's son. And what became of Louisa? In your response, please try to discuss at least three of the following. The speech that made his career, the specter of Adams' family enmity for Martin Van Buren, Whig and Democratic Party backlash, his opposition to the 1850 reauthorized Fugitive Slave Act, the death of his mother and editing of his grandfather's papers, and of course his friendship with Charles Sumner.
Okay, that's quite a lot. Let's talk about Charles
Just
Francis.
Three.
Yeah, I was going to say, let's start with the Free Soil campaign, because that's of course the campaign that makes Charles Francis a national figure. So at the same time he's serving in the State House, the big national issue is whether the Republic of Texas, which has been an independent republic since 1836, will join the United States. And for especially Whigs in New England, the idea that Texas will come in, it's such a huge piece of land. And there's even talk that it'll come in as two or three states, meaning four or six pro-slavery Democratic senators, a whole lot of congressmen down the road. And of course, it's the first time that slaves sold had come in since Missouri in 1820 and 21. So for Whigs in the North, like John Quincy, who's still in Congress, and Charles Francis, Texas is an indication that the country is just galloping in the wrong direction. And so in Congress, John Quincy is trying to keep it out. And in the State House, Charles Francis is very critical of the idea. And then, of course, in the wake of annexation, 45 comes the war with Mexico, 46 to 48. And all of a sudden, it's not just Texas. There's 500,000 square miles now, the Mexican cession, in the American Southwest. What was then a vast territory, New Mexico, and today Arizona, California, Colorado, Utah, Nevada, this huge chunk of land, and all exactly due west of the slaveholding South. And in the 19th century, Americans tend to move west along kind of neat little geothermal lines. So it's almost no one goes from Maine to Phoenix, Arizona. And of course, the South wants not just Texas, but the Southwest for political parity in the Senate. They realize, of course, they've been outgunned for years in the House where population matters. And they're talking about cotton production in New Mexico and what's now Arizona, and also, of course, mining, copper mining in what's now Arizona. So the Free Soil Party is the first ever kind of militant anti-slavery party. It just sort of emerges spontaneously in 1848. And it's not an abolition party. It simply is a keep slavery out of the West party. And, you know, then or now, most third parties are kind of a protest party. I'll vote for Ralph Nader in Florida. But I don't think he's going to win. These guys actually were playing to win. So they nominate for, they meet in Buffalo, and Adams is there at the convention. They nominate former President Martin Van Buren of New York. New York at the time, I mean, still is a big electoral prize. At the time, it was the big electoral prize. And Van Buren, a Democrat, had been critical of the annexation of Texas, and so he had kind of Free Soil credentials to back him up. And of course, again, if you want to win, you run, you know, the biggest name you can get, and Van Buren is the biggest name they can get. And he's not in Buffalo at the convention, but Adams is, and he realizes that he's going to be nominated. And so he actually flees the meeting at a church. He flees the church because he doesn't want it to look like he's, you know, campaigning or lobbying for the job. And of course, the reason he gets the nomination is because his father had just died that February, died, you know, literally in Congress. He falls out of his chair from having a second stroke. And so he's essentially chosen because he is Adams, not so much because of the anti-slavery work he's done that decade in Massachusetts. I mean, imagine today, you know, a major political party nominates for the second spot somebody who's done 5 years in the state assembly. It's just not going to happen. And so, in fact, when Adams is in Buffalo for the convention, he's wearing black mourning clothes. He has a black armband in memory of his father. So essentially, he's nominated to honor now the deceased John Quincy, as if almost like John Quincy was sort of still there. And of course, it makes him famous virtually overnight. One of the sources I used for the book, of course, are newspapers. I mean, all across the country, you know, he's hailed as being not, they don't say Charles Francis Adams, they say the son of John Quincy, comma, Charles Francis is now the vice presidential nominee. And it's awkward, obviously. Of course, this is the 19th century, and so one does not actually campaign. And so Adams and Van Buren don't campaign. They never meet one another. So it's not today where you have to appear at rallies with the person you're running with. But of course, John Quincy and Martin Van Buren had been for decades enemies. And so to have Charles Francis running as the running mate of the Democrat that the Whigs just really hated and despised was kind of a problem. And of course, both John Quincy and Charles Francis, as a young journalist, had been very critical of Van Buren. So parties loyal to the regular Whig nominee, Zachary Taylor, Louisiana slaveholder, had a field day running old editorials that both the Adamses had said about Martin Van Buren. And of course, they did not win, but they actually, for the third party campaign, they did better than any previous kind of fringe party had ever done. And so the Free Soil movement then does evolve into the Republican Party in the 1850s after the country is again astonished by Kansas, Nebraska, which is now going to allow slavery above the old Missouri Compromise line in the Midwest. So in many ways, it's not just a one-off campaign, but it is essentially the forerunner of the Republicans. And then Charles Francis does become one of the early adherents. He's kind of thrown out of the Whig Party for just being so anti-slavery. A lot of Whigs in Massachusetts own factories, cotton textiles, so they're getting their product from the slave South, and so they're really inclined to be kind of pull their punches when it comes to criticizing the South, and Adams is not. So he becomes a Republican before Lincoln or Seward quit the Whig Party and become a Republican. So he's a very early adherent and an architect of the party. Okay, you asked about the kids. Shall I come up talk about the kids? Like Louise? Okay. Or do you want me, I should have been keeping notes on what other issues were. Well, let me try it this way.
Including their time at Harvard, including meeting Rooney Lee.
Okay. Of course, all Adamses go to Harvard. They have since John Adams talked his way in as a young man. And when Charles Francis Sr. gets back from England after 8 years abroad, he's still very, very young. And it simply is a given that he will attend Harvard. In those days, people do attend a bit younger than today, where you're 18, 19 when you're a first-year student. But he's so much younger, he just feels lonely and alone, and no drinking laws in the 19th century. And so even as a very young student, Charles Francis finds himself probably drinking a bit too much, he admits, to his own diary. And that is a family issue. There's a lot of alcoholism in the family. At the same time, his sons. Oh, so he decides actually he's so unhappy there he wants to transfer to Yale. And if not that, he just wants to drop out. And so his father writes him and says, you know, we don't go to lesser schools like Yale. We are all Harvard men. And if you drop out, it's quite likely that you will end up in perdition. You'll sort of be doomed to hell. And so Charles Francis Sr. does kind of pull it back together and does finish Harvard, but is very, very young and then drifts for a time. His father, of course, is in Washington. This is before his time in Congress. And so Charles Francis comes to live in Washington, where he takes up with a mistress. And of course, all Adamses are notorious diarists. And so he mentions the mistress. He never names her. Probably working class woman in Washington. And so he calls her a mistress. And then it's Abigail Abby Brown Brooks and just falls head over heels in love with her. And again, she's wealthy and well-connected, but beautiful and sweet. And virtually the moment he meets her, he proposes to her, and her response is, not quite yet. And in fact, he bungles the proposal so badly. She thinks he's asking if they could just see each other more than they are. And he's actually asking to see her for life. And they're both still fairly young. And her father, again, who's rich, wants them to be engaged for a very long engagement, 2, 3, 4 years. And Charles Francis just can't wait. But not to his credit, he continues to see his mistress, and he finally decides the time has come to break it off. And he says in his diary, "A man is a fool to have a mistress." But even as he's courting Abby, he still is seeing his lady friend on the side. So he may not be the most perfect suitor, but the tradition goes hard in his family, and so all the sons go to Harvard, and oddly, his son Henry, who's his fourth child, becomes very good friends with Rooney Lee. Rooney Lee is the son of Robert E. Lee, and Rooney is handsome and he's popular. And you know, we tend to think of his father, Robert Lee, as this kind of old gray man. But you know, the war gives Robert Lee, you know, a heart attack and breaks his health. He's actually, you know, at the dawn of the war, still a pretty youngish, good looking man, and apparently Rooney was just very popular, but just dumb as a rock. And Henry kept helping him with his papers. And of course, Henry is 5'1", Rooney's very tall, handsome. And finally, Rooney just realizes he can't stay at Harvard anymore. And his father gets him a position in the army. And Henry even has to write his resignation letter from Harvard, because that's kind of beyond Rooney's abilities. But because of that friendship, even during the secession months, Henry has dinner at the Custis estate today, of course, Arlington Cemetery, and then stays in touch with Rooney and sees him on occasion after the war. So it's kind of a very odd North and South friendship. The child of Charles Francis, who is, of course, the most tragic, is the eldest, and that's Louisa. And again, to be the first child of an Adams, in this case, the first child of Charles Francis and Abby, would mean great things. That he, if he was Lewis, would be next in line to be senator, congressman, attorney, attend Harvard, of course. But Louisa is not Lou. And according to her brothers, especially Henry, Louisa is far and away just the smartest of their generation. But that public life is not going to be her role. I could never tell whether I should feel annoyed with Louisa or sorry for Louisa or both. Sorry in that she's brilliant and there's not going to be a Harvard in her future, but neither does she attempt the kind of roles during the war that other elite women perform. Robert Gould Shaw, the colonel of the Black Regiment 54th, his mother raises money during the war, you know, sews uniforms, sends care packages, and Louisa, who marries unhappily, she marries a wealthy attorney and doctor, she sort of wanders around Europe, and she has a miscarriage, which apparently damages her ability to have any more children, so she never does, and of course, that's also part of the problem. To be an elite woman in the 19th century, wife and mother are your designated roles, and she can be wife but not mother. We don't really know much about the marriage, although it's a disaster. She comes home from the honeymoon and tries to move back in with her parents. And they reconcile, they wander off to Europe, and she comes back and she's unhappy, and she's always unwell. And at one point, Charles Francis says in his diary, you know, I think her illness is not physical, it's psychological. So again, part of me feels that the world was simply unfair to her. Were she born today to the kind of family that she comes from, she would be, you know, not just writing speeches, but running for the presidency. But so many women, Dorothea Dix, the Boston school teacher who organizes the nursing corps for Lincoln, there's so much she could do as an Adams during the war. She has a brother who's serving. She has a father who is ambassador to England. She has another brother, Henry, who is the ambassador's secretary. She drifts. And finally, in 1870, she's outside of Florence, Italy, driving a carriage too fast and rolls the carriage and it crushes her leg. And the doctors want to take it off and she refuses. And Henry gets there before she dies. And she dies of gangrene and is buried in the English cemetery in Florence. They lost her grave for a time. The graveyard is in terrible condition, but it fell over and they've now found it. So I took a picture of this kind of piece of marble lying on the ground. So she's kind of the tragic child of that fourth generation.
So given his election as Massachusetts's third district representative, his 1860 so-called classic free soil disquisition, and his joint campaign with Seward for Abraham Lincoln after the Republican National Convention, why did Charles Francis attempt to compromise with secessionists by entertaining the repeal of personal liberty laws and supporting the doctrine of popular sovereignty for slave and free soil? And in your response, please address the personal and professional backlash, personal and professional consequences of Republican backlash, and then three of the following. Charles Francis' speech on possible anti-slavery amendments, his perceptions of the Lincolns, and then also maybe Henry's studies in Berlin with Louisa, as well as John Quincy Jr.'s and Charles Francis Jr.'s careers.
Okay. again, quite a lot.
So just three of the following. You can limit it to three.
I'll start with Congress, because that again is very telling. So after the Free Soil campaign, Charles Francis sort of went back to his old pursuits for most of the 1850s, went back to his coin collection and managing the family's estates, which were considerable. And he was pretty good at it. He made a lot of money investing, buying land, selling land. He had a real chance in 1851 for national greatness. In those days, of course, senators were chosen by state assemblies. And the Whig senator, a guy named Robert Rantoul, was unwell and was dying. And so friends and anti-slavery reformers were pushing for Adams to be replaced, to replace him in the U.S. Senate. And he was very, very interested in doing so. But Ollie Adams has adhered to an earlier American political culture. So he says at one point to his diary, I would love to be the senator, but I can't appear to be lobbying for it. In fact, essentially, the legislature has to choose me and without any lifting a finger on my part, and then I'll be the senator, but only if it's popular acclaim, you know, vast majority choose him. And by the 1850s, most American politicians are uncomfortable or tired of that kind of Hamlet pose. And again, that's the way, you know, John Adams does not lobby to become vice president. He simply is chosen as vice president and inherits the mantle of office. And that's what Charles Francis is looking for, is basically them to come to him. And he'd been editing a paper, and he owned it because he had money. And so one of his longtime friends and associates, who's also working on the paper but didn't have that kind of cash to buy in, was Charles Sumner, who's a little bit younger than Adams. And so Adams is kind of the senior partner of this Massachusetts anti-slavery, you know, duo. And at one point, Adams says to Sumner, well, you know, you should do it. And this is almost kind of dismissive, like, you're the kind of person willing to sort of, you know, lobby for this job. And Sumner says, you're the senior partner. You know, you should, this is your seat. And Adams won't lift a finger. And so finally, Sumner says, yeah, I'd like to have it. And so, of course, Sumner then serves in the Senate till his death. And if Adams just lifted a finger, he would have been Senator Charles Francis Adams, and possibly would have been the front runner in 1860 for the presidential nomination, not William Seward. So he sits out most of the 1850s and finally does agree to run for Congress in 1858 and easily, of course, wins. Adams never really got Lincoln. He'd become very close to Seward as kind of a family friend. When Seward lost the nomination, essentially the first person he came to see was Charles Francis, and this kind of sad dinner. And like a lot of people in New England who didn't really know much about Lincoln, Lincoln seemed to be this kind of tall, lanky, inexperienced frontiersman with you know, bad suit and sort of bad manners. And rarely, Adams never really changed his position on Lincoln very much. He would get you know, a formal statement that Lincoln had made a Gettysburg address, second inaugural Thanksgiving statement. And he'd always say, that was pretty good. So it couldn't really have been Lincoln who wrote that. It must have been Seward who wrote that. And of course, it was Lincoln. So their congressman Adams was in the midst of Southern secession. And this was a position he took that cost him his friendship with Charles Sumner. So there's both the House and Senate committee trying to find some kind of compromise or really conciliatory package to keep the South in. And Adams finds himself on the House committee. It's called the Committee of 33 because there's 33 people on this committee. And of course, the Lower South is already out the door. The South Carolina is out the door in December 1860. So the hope for people like Adams is to hold the Upper South, Virginia, Tennessee, Maryland, in place with a package of concessions. And the Lower South will then realize in a year's time that they simply can't survive without Maryland, Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee. They'll come back. So he does try to make the kind of concessions that will, you know, win the Upper South back. And again, he finds himself in this kind of moderate position where he's not giving enough for those like John J. Crittenden, who's orchestrating the Senate package to the South. But he's also giving more than Sumner believes they should get. And so he does two things. They get some really hot water with his constituents. And of course, I was reading his correspondence, and he gets some very angry hate mail from his voters. One is he scales way back on his longstanding support for personal liberty laws. And Seward especially is pushing this one really hard. Will kind of remove any of these laws and essentially offer any protection to runaway slaves or people allegedly who have run away in the North. And that causes some headaches. But the one that really gets him in trouble, of course, the White South, what they want, again, is American Southwest. So Adams is willing to allow for the possibility of slavery in the New Mexico Territory, which, again, spans from Texas to California to today, New Mexico and Arizona. And here, too, he has the law on his side. He says, well, look, the Dred Scott decision, 1857, which is still standing, Taney's still alive at the time, bans Congress from banning slavery in the territories. And so therefore, the position I'm taking is in fact consistent with U.S. Supreme Court. It's legalistic. It's constitutional. It also points out the obvious, which at that moment, there's only a dozen slaves in New Mexico, and they're almost all domestic servants who belong to U.S. Army officers. And so Adams says, under the Compromise of 1850, which opened up the Southwest under the guise of popular sovereignty, he said, you know, slaveholders have had a decade to move slaves into the Southwest, and they haven't yet. And so, therefore, why make a big deal out of this if it will kind of cool off tempers in Virginia and keep them in the Union? So again, you know, like throughout his career, what you find him doing is taking these very legalistic, and he's got the law on his side, he's got Supreme Court on his side. But of course, he's ultimately wrong, and on several grounds. One, planters, of course, are not going to take expensive slave property into a territory only to watch it be manumitted when that state comes in as a free state and writes a free state constitution. So what the White South wants is a guarantee that they will always have New Mexico, Arizona, South California as slave soil. Adams also, of course, he's never been to the South. And so he conflates slavery and cotton, and he says, well, you know, it's arid out there. And so obviously, you know, the western part of New Mexico, Arizona, is not going to be, you know, really great for cotton. But of course, when Jefferson Davis talks about the territories, he's talking about mining. Plus, you think from a guy who's a state that has canals, Adams would get the concept of irrigation. I was born and raised in Phoenix. I had one grandfather who grew cotton outside Phoenix, another who grew cotton in New Mexico, Las Cruces. And so you can bring water, you know, to the land. And so cotton can be grown in the Southwest. And again, there's a lot of things you can use slaves for. So that really causes a kind of a permanent rupture. Sumner comes for dinner. They literally have this sort of big shouting match. And that dissolves this longstanding partnership between Adams and Sumner. And his correspondence regarding Sumner becomes sort of ever meaner and a bit sort of nastier. Adams believes that when Sumner is caned and almost dies, you know, beaten by Preston Brooks, that it's never quite the same afterwards. But basically, he's just, they don't agree on policy. So for Adams, that makes Sumner wrong. And so that for me was kind of a position that was tough to defend. And again, he chooses legalisms over humanity. And at one point, he says to Sumner, well, there's only 12 slaves. In the Southwest, and Sumner says, Adams, that's 12 slaves too many. So if you're one of those 12 slaves, it does matter to you. If you've been, you know, carried there and your family is dissolved by some U.S. Army officer from Virginia who's now in New Mexico, you know, that matters to you a great deal. So for Adams, it's never about the people. It's always about the law. But of course, it is also then his support for Seward that wins him the spot of becoming Lincoln's ambassador to Great Britain. So it costs him one friendship, but the friendship with Sumner, pardon me, with Seward, that opens up a whole new door for him.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
What were the impulses for and reactions to Lincoln's and Seward's appointment of Charles Francis as a minister ambassador to Great Britain? In addition, how and why did Charles Francis attempt to preclude British support for the Confederacy and resolve the Trent Affair? And what were the envoys' subsequent diplomatic strategies? you can address a variety of topics, including the Alabama Construction, the diplomatic consequences of Antietam, the Emancipation Proclamation, etc.
Sure. And Adams was just a perfect. He promised to do 4 years. He wound up doing seven because every time he was ready to come home, a new crisis, Lincoln was assassinated. And in part because, again, he really knew Europe. He'd lived in London. He knew Europe in a way that most Americans did not. He also was very cool and balanced. And so I think in some ways what made him, not a very good father, the fact that he's sort of cold and distant made him a perfect diplomat. And Seward, his boss in the State Department, had done a brief tour of Europe and a brief tour of England, but didn't really know the people, didn't know the politics, and was always very inclined to write these sort of incendiary notes to Adams. He would say, read this verbatim. John Russell was the British Foreign Secretary. Read this verbatim to Russell. And Adams would take a deep breath and write back and say, I'm going to change a word here or there. He would kind of soften the blow. So it was still tough, but it wasn't the kind of incendiary language Seward was inclined to use. I mean, Seward, of course, had been in New York State politics for 30 years, he made a lot of anti-English statements as a way to kind of appeal to Irish and Irish American voters. Not with any success, they voted Democratic, and he was a Whig. But there was kind of a long history of tough things going back for decades that Seward had said about the British. So Adams, softened that blow. And also, of course, as a former congressman, he really understood British politics. He understood who was for the U.S., who was for the Confederacy, what class, what region. And he really knew how to use politicians who might be on his side. And so kind of the larger context here is that Lincoln's growing naval blockade to the American South was denying cotton to British factories. And before the war, half of all American cotton went to Britain. A quarter went to New England. A quarter went to France. So these big factory towns like Manchester, they're just nothing but cotton textile factories, took a real hit. Workers were underemployed. Workers were laid off. And so, of course, the Southern hope is that if this pinched the British economy enough, and certainly the great cotton lords, the guys who owned the cotton factories, were very pro-Confederacy. If the workers really turn against the U.S., that would be kind of a decisive blow. And so Adams immediately befriended two kind of old radicals, Cobden and Bright, and who'd been involved in the anti-corn law movement, which was a British, essentially food tariff on cheap American wheat. And so every time they would write Bright or Cobden some kind of pro-U.S. Statement, petition, he would formally meet with them. He would make sure it was published in British papers and American papers. We tried really hard to get people who represented or who had friends in the English working class kind of on his side. So he really knew how to use PR to that extent. And I think that's one thing that I did not appreciate as I went into the project was how smart he was politically on the ground in Britain, and not just what he was doing relative to the Prime Minister Palmerston or the Foreign Secretary John Russell. He knew when to soften the blow, but he also knew when to be tough. And he also understood the impact that events on the battlefield were having on foreign policy. So after Antietam and after the Emancipation Proclamation, that certainly complicated Palmerston's desire. And Palmerston was kind of leaning toward recognizing the Confederacy. That made it very difficult in the U.S. The hardcore abolitionists like Garrison were vocal, but pretty small in number. Britain, of course, had gotten rid of slavery in its Caribbean Empire, Jamaica, Grenada, Barbados in the 1830s. And so British anti-slavery forces were really pretty mainstream, connected, and powerful. And so every time, the war went the U.S.'s way and not the Confederates' way, then Adams would kind of renew certain agendas with Palmerston and Russell. And Russell and Adams, by the way, actually sort of looked alike. They're both about 5'3", baldish. Actually developed kind of a very, very good relationship. But finally, after Gettysburg, when, of course, it was pretty clear to anybody paying attention, the South now was not going to win. And Britain, by the way, was just stunned because they're reading in the paper that Robert Lee has now invaded a second time United States, and they're quite sure the next thing they read will be that Lee crushes Meade's army, goes waltzing into Philadelphia or Washington, like has to agree to a separate peace. And then word arrives that Lee's been devastated at Gettysburg. And Henry, who of course is there with his father, was just thought it was really amusing the way the London Times, which is very anti-US, just had a hard time publishing the truth, because it just hurt them actually to say, you know, the US had won this really big battle. But Adams knew that's when the time had come now to really get tough on especially the building of Confederate rams, usually under kind of dummy corporations, but in British dockyards. And so the Alabama, a bunch of had gotten away, but they're building more. And so at that point, Russell had to consider what's the possibility if the North does win. They're now very anti-English. There, of course, is Canada, just to the North, which is always kind of in play. And when it looks like two other ships being built are going to slip out of the docks. And Russell says at one point, Adams, it's being built by a private company. They've got, again, dummy corporations that are allegedly buying this, not the Confederates. And Adams writes this kind of wonderfully succinct note to Russell. And he says, you realize, your lordship, this means war. And that's all he has to say is if these ships escape, now down the road, there's going to be war. And if the war is over in the U.S. and the North wins, and now what happens to British shipping? Can it be easy prey for American privateers? And so at that moment, Russell writes back and says, we're in agreement, clamps down, seizes the ships right before they could flee the docks. And so Adams knew when to sort of back off of Seward's rhetoric, but he also really knew when the time had come to just kind of lay it on the line. And I love that phrase, your lordship, you realize this means war.
Why did Charles Francis Jr. enlist in the 1st Massachusetts Cavalry, despite his father's, Charles Francis Sr.'s, concerns? Also, what were Charles Francis Jr.'s reactions to African-Americans at Port Royal and Beaufort? And why did he refrain from becoming, as he put it, a quote-unquote N-word driver? And, you know, in your response, you can discuss his relationship with the senior officers, his violations of protocol, and then his trials and travails at Lake Frederick.
But when Charles Francis Sr. left for Britain, and John Quincy, who just wanted to be a gentleman farmer, he's in charge of the old house. And Charles Francis took Henry, the fourth child, third son, with him as a secretary. In those days, American ministers abroad had a very, very small detail. So he has one kind of permanent secretary who came with the job, and he brings Henry with him as an unsalaried secretary to basically sort of copy all of his letters. So Charles Francis, his namesake, Jr., is the child he has the most confidence in. And I think correctly, you know, Dad has come to see John Quincy II as being sort of an affable ne'er-do-well guy. He just wants to plant trees. So Charles Francis is going to be the person in charge of the family's investments, estates, stock. They've got, you know, quite a bit. And so his job is to stay home. Plus, Adamses don't fight. And if you go back to the Revolution, Adamses are diplomats, they're statesmen, they're attorneys, they're law professors. They're not soldiers. And of course, John Adams famously referred to George Washington as a lucky soldier, you know, a guy who kind of got all the attention. So Charles Francis is supposed to just kind of stay home for 4 years. But of course, all of his Harvard pals immediately go up after Fort Sumter, enlist. And he actually goes down to the train to wave them goodbye. And they're all cheering and waving. And they're, you know, the band of brothers all leaving together. And there he is. And he's also bored by the mundane aspects of law. Just, you know, the kind of stuff he's doing, writing Hurd on their tenants and doing wills, things like that. He's just bored out of his mind. And of course, the assumption is that the war will be short, the U.S. will win handily, and then that summer comes Bull Run. It's a major disaster. He has friends at Bull Run. And he starts to think that it's actually dishonorable for an Adams not to serve. And he writes to his mother to kind of get her ready for what's coming. And he says, you know, we are the first family of the Republic, you know, going back to John and Abigail. We've also been the first family of kind of anti-slavery legislators going back to you know, Grandpa John Quincy in Congress. And the Amistad case he deals with. And Charles Francis Jr. says to his mother, this law, family, all families, you know, not to be involved in the fight, and not just sitting here, you know, doing mundane things. And he said, you know, history is being written. You know, the country's story, he says, is being written. And here I am, he puts it, without a pen. So he finally just enlists in the 1st Cavalry, Massachusetts. And again, in those days, the way it works is you enlist in a state regiment that is folded into the larger National Army. But it's a state regiment created by the governor, Don A. Andrew. And it's a fairly elite regiment. Even being an officer in the infantry is a fairly basic job. But cavalry requires a lot of training. It's much more expensive to put together a cavalry unit. It helps if you are a rich kid who can bring your own horse and your own gear, which Adams does. So without telling his parents, he enlists. And there it's his father that fall. This is the fall of 61. He says, well, you know, I've joined. And I didn't like it. I knew he'd be horrified. But lays out the case. We are, you know, the American family. It's simply wrong for us having helped to kind of bring on this crisis, not to help resolve it. And he says, I've joined up and now you know. And when in London, Charles Francis gets the letter, he's horrified. And he responds by not responding. He just never writes back. He does, though, say in his diary, I don't understand this. He says, you know, Adams says, we're not soldiers and we've never been one. And why does he think he has to be one? And he said, the family's hopes are with him. And again, oldest sibling, Louisa, is a girl. He'll be the next famous Adams, and he's going to die in battle. And he's risking his life, and I don't understand why. And so finally, Henry writes back for his father and says, well, yeah, I support you. I don't really get it, but I'll support you. But I'm just, you know, try not to get shot. Try not to get killed. And Adams discovers he's actually a very good cavalryman. Being an Adams, again, he's the one who says being a contrarian is an admirable thing. He doesn't really learn to love the guys in his unit, but he likes them enough, and they'll kind of bond. And it turns out he's actually quite good at this. You look at most sources, you look at Wikipedia, it says that he fought at Gettysburg. He's so far in the back at Gettysburg, and of course they're all trying to converge on the battlefield. He's so far in the back, you can hear it way in the distance, you know, the battle rumbling. He's been in the saddle for days, and so he actually sleeps through most of Gettysburg. He just gets off his horse, ties his horse to a branch, and goes to sleep, wakes up every now and then, makes sure the horse hasn't wandered off. But he's involved just before that at the Battle of Aldie, which is in Loudoun County, Virginia, just south of D.C., and it's on a kind of a strategic thoroughfare heading south. They're surprised by a Confederate cavalryman, and his unit is really cut up badly. And he leads with great courage and presence of mind. He tells his men to dismount. They find a small wall. They're shooting behind. People are getting blasted off their horses. And what's interesting, he writes to his brother after the John Quincy, not to his father. He doesn't really want his father to know how close he came to being shot. And again, the casualties for the U.S. side in Aldie is pretty severe. Right, so John Quincy says, I have no idea why I'm still alive. You know, all my men were being shot. My wonderful unit has been decimated. But basically, you know, write to Dad and tell him I'm fine. Not a big deal, kind of no. So every time he's in a battle like that, he writes to John Quincy or Louise and says, you know, write to Dad and make sure that he understands I'm fine, I'm well. And it was kind of nothing to be concerned about. And in several cases, he actually is, you know, really in the front line. So you know, he did put his life on the line. His big chance then comes, and he actually has some time off. So he goes to Europe to see the family. And what's interesting is that when he's briefly in London on this kind of brief vacation, his father, of course, never gets around to saying, I'm proud of you for doing this. Always wants to introduce him as the captain. Here's my son, the captain. So kind of quietly, Charles Francis Sr. is very proud of Charles Francis Jr. But I just find it so sad, the one person he can't bring himself to say, I'm proud of you, is those words to his son. So everyone else, he introduces him as the captain. Adams then comes back and the state has decided to put together the first ever black cavalry unit, the 5th Massachusetts. There was some debate about what was the first U.S. black regiment. Was it the 54th with the South Carolina Volunteers? So the state wants to be very clear that they're going to have the first ever black cavalry unit. And they offer Charles Francis Jr. the second spot. And he thinks about it and finally does accept. And his concern is that he simply thinks he won't like the guys in his regiment. And he has been, the 1st Cavalry actually was down in the South on the Carolina coast. And so he had his first kind of real experience in seeing African-Americans, black refugees, contraband. And the really disheartening thing about Charles Francis Adams was his overt racism. His father, Charles Francis Sr., in the 40s would speak at Faneuil Hall, speak on the Boston stage beside Frederick Douglass. And he would say in his diary, I spoke today on the same stage as the Negro Douglass, or I spoke on the same stage as the colored man Wells. But he never uses the N-word. So he was aware, Dad was, of race and pigmentation, but never used the N-word. Charles Francis and John Quincy II use it like they have Tourette's. Charles Francis simply cannot bring himself to use the word Negro or colored. It's just always the N-word. And it is clear from day one that he has no understanding of who these people are. He says this one kind of very long and very confused letter to Henry when he's down on the Carolina coast. He says, you know, they're lazy and they're thieves and they'll lie to you. But they seem to want to work. So he doesn't understand the kind of the contradiction in that passage that they're ready to work. They've always been working, but just for someone else, they want to work for themselves. He says derogatory things. They have big feet. It just goes on and on. I mean, you'd think you're reading kind of a bad Mark Twain novel and not the grandson of John Quincy Adams. And that's basically his attitude when he's with the 5th Cavalry. And then finally, Russell, his senior commander, is badly wounded at a place called Baylor's Farm. So Charles Francis Jr. becomes the colonel and does, in fact, lead his men into Richmond. They're the first mounted unit into Richmond when it falls in 65. And it's the one time in the letter he refers to his men as black. Like his moment of pride, they're marching into the city, and he writes to his father and says, again, how marvelous it is that an Adams, you know, has led a black regiment into Richmond. It's the one time he doesn't use the N-word or colored, even uses the term black. So he never learns to like or understand the men in his regiment. And by the way, one of his corporals is Charles Douglas, the baby boy of the great black abolitionist. And as far as I can tell, Adams never knows that Fred Douglas's son, who his father had you know, spoken at Faneuil Hall with, is one of his junior officers. He just has no interest in getting to know these guys and is mustered out at the end of the war, still complaining about his Negroes. And again, he's not using that word. He's using the N-word. So again, this was the problem of balance I had in the book. I mean, how do you write about somebody who does volunteer to lead black troops, a pioneering regiment, but just is utterly dismissive and openly racist when it comes to talking about the guys under his command?
So you've addressed actually a number of topics. Let's skip ahead a little bit. And can you discuss a bit what Charles Francis Sr.'s and Charles Francis Jr.'s, as well as maybe the British public's perspectives were on Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, the second election, the second inaugural, and the subsequent assassination, as well as their perspectives on the post-surrender black codes and extension of war powers?
Charles Francis Sr., as I mentioned, you know, a moment ago, he just never got the greatness of Lincoln. And I should go back a step and say also that during the campaign of 1860, Charles Francis Jr. has just finished college and he's not sure kind of what the next step is. And so family friend Seward says, well, come with me on a campaign. And we're going to go west. And so Seward actually meets Lincoln. This is right after the convention in 60, and he's got young Charles Francis with him. And Charles Francis says, you know, here's the sort of tall, you know, it's totally fit. You know, he shakes your hand with both of his kind of giant paws. I mean, and that's kind of the usual Adams, you know, view of Lincoln is this sort of kind of giant frontier yokel. But Henry does, maybe because Henry is the wordsmith. You know, Henry, of course, goes on to be the novelist and the historian. He's also, from 1860 on, is also writing editorials, usually anonymous, for American newspapers. And so both Charles Francis Jr. and Henry really get the Gettysburg Address. And Charles Francis Jr. writes to his father and says, you know, what about, you know, the prodigy from Illinois? You know what? That's just an amazing. He sums up the war, American ideals in kind of 3 minutes or less. Charles Francis Sr. still comes from the period where, like Edward Everett, his brother-in-law, you get up and a short speech is 4 hours. You know, you just kind of go on forever. And so nailing it in 3 minutes, the Gettysburg Address, the second inaugural, which of course is one of the great speeches of the 19th century. Charles Francis Sr. never really gets, but the boys do come to appreciate his greatness, both as a leader, I think in part because the Adams family assumption is that when it comes to foreign policy, that Seward is always calling the shots and Lincoln is just the hands-off kind of guy. And that's in part because of the first meeting between Lincoln and Charles Francis Adams Sr. When Adams is named at Seward's prodding to be minister, he travels down to meet Lincoln and kind of be debriefed. And Lincoln looks at him and says, well, you're Seward's guy, and the two of you kind of handle it. And he goes off to like do something really minor. He's going to decide he's going to be the postmaster of Chicago. And so from day one, Charles Francis Sr. assumes that Lincoln is kind of the puppet and Seward's the guy really kind of orchestrating policy. I think in part because Charles Francis Jr. is in the States, he starts to realize that, in fact, especially when it comes to domestic policy, Lincoln is his own guy, that he's nobody's puppet. And again, I think as the wordsmith in the family, Henry realizes, you know, how utterly brilliant, Lincoln's two celebrated speeches are. So they come to understand it. Then, of course, you know, the war is over and Charles Francis Sr., he's done his 4 years. He wants to come home. His father, bear in mind, of course, was abroad for 8 years, but Ambassador Madison's ambassador to England for only two. So Charles Francis Sr. has already been in England twice as long as his father. He's ready to come home. Then word arrives that Lincoln's been assassinated and that Seward has been badly, badly cut up in the assassination attempt. And they assume first he's going to die. So if nothing else, Adams realizes that means he's not coming home anytime soon. He does agree to stay on in London. And his fear, which is rather telling, his fear is that Seward is so badly hurt. You know, he's attacked by an assassin too with a knife. Then Lincoln shot, that he'll have to come back himself and serve in the State Department. And he's horrified by that prospect. But interestingly, not because he thinks that Johnson's attempts to conciliate the White South are wrongheaded. He simply thinks that Johnson is kind of a Southern lowlife and he doesn't want to sort of have to serve under. But ironically, he doesn't really have any complaints about Johnson's policies. And again, here you see Adams being legalistic as opposed to concerned about human rights. So from day one, you know, the White South, because in fact they are being treated very, very overly kindly by the new accidental president, Andrew Johnson, began to pass black codes. And black codes are an attempt for the states to essentially get around the 13th Amendment and hold on to race and class prerogatives. So they give a handful of blacks a handful of rights. They can marry now. But you have to get a labor contract in most states by January 1. If not, the state will get one for you. Some states make talking back to your employer, I mean, being uppity, a crime, you know, that kind of thing. So what they're trying to do is to circumvent 13th Amendment and hold on to slavery just under a different name. And Adams is kind of okay with that. And especially John Quincy, his son, the second, really thinks that the black voting rights are just kind of way too over, not just too quick, but too extreme. So all the Adamses, of course, are firmly anti-slavery. They're thrilled to see the amendment pass, thrilled to see slavery die. What happens next? They're pretty ambivalent about it, and certainly using federal power to ensure black voting rights. They're very critical of the 14th Amendment. They don't like the 15th Amendment. They don't like, and to a certain extent, John Quincy, who doesn't come back from Europe until 68, gets kind of avoid all this. Although his correspondence makes it very clear, when he's writing to Republicans, he's writing back and saying things like, I just don't agree with you on this. You're mangling the Constitution. You're using way too much federal power. But by that point, John Quincy II is running for office as a Democrat. And of course, having an Adams run essentially as an anti-black Democrat in Massachusetts gets a huge amount of national press and attention. And so it's quite clear the entire family is not going in the same direction as the Republican Party, and certainly not the direction that, that Charles Sumner is helping to lead it in the Senate. So it's they are typical, I'll say this, of a lot of Republicans who are moderates, who, of course, want to sew the nation back together. They're opposed to secession. They are opposed to slavery. They want to see the 13th Amendment. But for them, it's done. The crusade is over. Slavery's dead. Bear in mind, of course, that voting rights was always a state prerogative. And so as late as 64, you know, Black Americans cannot vote in Lincoln's Illinois, in Pennsylvania, in Ohio. So to a certain extent, the Adams family collective position on Black voting rights is not that different from other kind of moderate Republicans. But they're Adamses. You know, they're the descendants of John Quincy, who, as he's literally dying in the House, is condemning the war with Mexico as a pro-slavery, unjust war. So it would be one thing if they were just some Republican moderate governor from Indiana who didn't want to go out on a limb for Black voting rights, but they are, again, America's first family, and they're America's first anti-slavery family. And this is you know, a rather depressing position for them to collectively take.
So what's Charles Francis Jr. doing? Can you discuss just really briefly his Railroad Commission ideas in the North American Review and American Law Review?
Well, Charles Francis Jr. comes back from the war and isn't really sure kind of what the next act in his life is going to be. The one thing he does know, he's met a woman named Minnie Ogden when he's on leave during the war. And he's just, from day one, he's just mad for Minnie, in part because she's really pleasant. She's really kind. And he writes a letter to Henry, and he says, she's the exact opposite of me. And so she kind of balanced me out because I'm just kind of unpleasant, and she's just really charming. And so we're the kind of perfect pair. She also has a lot of money, which always matters to the Adams family. So the one thing he has agreed on is he's going to marry Minnie, and they get married as soon as he's out of the army. He's very, very ill by the time he leaves the army. He's lost a lot of weight. He's not a big guy to start with. He's had malaria. You know, getting his health back, he does a European tour, goes to see Dad, introduce Minnie to his parents. Then he comes back. He's not really sure what to do next. The one thing he knows he doesn't want to do is go back to the law. He just hated that. He has several offers for partnerships in law firms, and he's turns them all down. So he decides that railroads are the coming thing. And, of course, he's not wrong on that. I mean, the years right after the war, the heyday of American railroad construction. But again, he takes a really interesting position, which is kind of a typical Adams position. He does believe in regulation. And so he starts writing essays and law reviews in the Atlantic Magazine and kind of very sort of visible places, hoping that they will then essentially kind of turn into a position with the railroads or with brand new railroad commissions, you know, kind of corporate commissions on the state level. So he does believe in regulation, which kind of puts him at odds with sort of the Grant wing of the party, which is just this shovel cash at the railroads. But also because, again, for an Adams, it's the best men, people like himself, who should be sort of running post-war America and not the sort of nouveau riche industrialists and financiers. So again, he does believe in regulation, but merely so people like himself can basically be in charge. And it does get him a position with a railroad commission in Massachusetts, and finally rises to be the CEO, the president of Union Pacific, which he does for about a decade. Until he's finally forced out in 1890 by the financier Jay Gould. So ironically, he's kind of forced out by one of these sort of awful nouveau riche people he's been writing against, you know, decades, who are not the Harvard types, not the best men. But he becomes essentially kind of a robber baron, although a rather, you know, genteel one. But there's the painting of him late in life, like any other robber baron, wearing a, you know, elegant tuxedo, holding his cigar, cashing his check, and he's very dismissive of labor unions, which he derides as being, he calls them Celtic, so the, you know, Irish in the East or you know, Asian in the West. And his racism never abates, it now kind of spreads. So I think a lot of his racism is based as much on class as his race, because he says the same kinds of things about Irish workers, Irish voters, that he does about Black voters in the South or about Asian workers in the far West. So he does cash in. And again, for me, that's kind of part of the story of the family decline. It goes from being one of service to nation, service to one's fellows, to be, we can make a lot of money at this. And that's kind of a Gilded Age norm, I guess. But again, it'd be, I think, a bit finer had he opted for a different kind of life after the war. You know, other officers go into politics, and he went into business.
Can you discuss a bit Charles Francis Sr. and the rise of the liberal Republicans, as well as the Adams family support for Samuel Tilden and the 1876 Democrats, and then finally Henry's courtship and marriage to Clover Hopper, as well as his love for Lizzie Sherman?
A lot of good stories there. So Charles Francis Sr., of course, comes back in 1868, and he comes back just in time for Grant to be elected. And once again, his concern is that he'll be asked to be Secretary of State. And on one hand, he badly wants that, because in the 19th century, the State Department, not the vice presidency, is the stepping stone to the Oval Office. So if he does two terms as Secretary of State, then he's kind of up next in the Republican Party. And actually, they have this kind of very funny meeting. Grant comes to New England, and there's this big public dinner in Boston. They're both invited to, and the press assumption is that they're going to kind of check each other out. Maybe an offer will be forthcoming. And Adams and Grant spend most of the dinner kind of staring at each other across the room. And of course, Adams would have been a terrific choice for the State Department. But Grant is a classic outsider, you know, kind of like Eisenhower in the 20th century, wants to be his own guy. And so to choose the person who now, with Seward out of politics and Lincoln dead, is kind of Mr. Republican, would be an indication that he's not really kind of in charge of his own cabinet. So Adams does not get the spot. And he says to his diary, "Well, I'm really thrilled. It's not really clear to me how thrilled he is to be sort of ignored by Grant." He clearly thinks, and Henry also thinks, that Grant is just a moron. I mean, they have a really low opinion of Grant. So Adams goes back into sort of his private life. But then the first ship that did escape from British clutches is called the Alabama, which did a huge amount of damage to U.S. shipping during the war. And so the Grant administration is essentially suing the British for damages. And so they do tap Adams to go to Geneva, Switzerland, to be part of this commission to try to get damages. And it's essentially kind of an international court tribune. And Adams is just, you know, in his element at this. And he was just hoping to get a judgment on the part of the U.S., get kind of a small sum, sort of teach the British a lesson, you know, don't do this again. They're hoping they'll get maybe, you know, $1 million, $2 million, and the tribunal fines for the U.S. And awards the U.S. $15 million in British pound sterling. It's just this spectacular success. So coming hard on the heels of being the great minister to Britain, Adams is now once again famous in all the news for being the guy who gets this spectacular judgment against the British and brings all this cash home. And so, of course, by now it's 1872. So once more, the question is kind of what will he do next in an election year? And by this point, a lot of reformers, at least white reformers, have become very unhappy with Grant's sort of turning a blind eye to the corruption in Congress, in his own cabinet. Grant himself was not a corrupt person, but he actually had people in his cabinet who were taking bribes. And that was also kind of the mood of Washington at the time. So for a lot of white reformers, they want to get somebody like Adams, you know, again, the best man, back into position. I call them those liberal Republicans, meaning reform-minded Republicans. But here, too, there's a racial divide. By 72, Grant was sort of backing off of kind of the peaks of clamping down on the white South. They'd passed a law called the Klan Act, you know, literally going after Klan members using federal marshals. And so black Republicans, like Frederick Douglass, who now is a firmly in the Republican camp, they're still on Grant's side, because Grant figures the one guy occasionally willing to kind of slap down white Southern violence. And so black Republicans are all for a second term for Grant. White reformers, you know, kind of not so much, but they're also divided. One of Grant's great critics is Charles Sumner. But of course, Sumner still has not achieved any kind of detente with Adams. And so the kind of coalition is divided. But here, too, all Adams has to do is to say, "I'd like the nomination," because they meet in a separate Republican liberal convention. And in Washington, Charles Francis Jr. and Henry are pushing really hard for debt. But again, once more, and as he's coming back from Geneva, you know, the press is just you know, lauding his accomplishments. All he has to do, again, is simply say, you know, "I'm in," and he won't. They have to come to him hand in hand, you know, ask him to run. He also thinks probably Grant is unbeatable in 72, and probably he's right. That said, had Grant been challenged by Adams from the liberal progressive reform view, and then been reelected, Adams would have been then probably up for 76. But Adams also knew what no one else knew is that he was starting to suffer from memory loss, kind of early hints of dementia, and was quite concerned that by 1876 he would not be the man he'd been in 1866. So kind of once more the prize is lost. All the press is speculating, will he become the third President Adams? And of course he doesn't. And by not running in 72, he then also takes the pressure off the fourth generation. The worst case scenario for John Quincy II, Charles Francis Jr., Henry, is that if Dad does become the third President Adams, they're up next. You know, they're just the Kennedys. They can't get away from it. So the fact that Charles Francis never gets the brass ring and never becomes the third President Adams then takes the pressure off of those kids who do not want to be in politics. Henry does. Charles Francis, John Quincy II, they just don't.
What about Henry's courtship and marriage to Clover Hopper and Lizzie Sherman, as well as his rise as a historian and novelist?
So after the war, Henry moves to Washington. I think in part to kind of escape the sort of family control of Massachusetts. He starts writing essays, editorials. He buys a house, you know, literally adjacent to the White House. I think it's pretty clear what he's hoping is, in the same way that Charles Francis Jr., his brother's editorials about railroads are going to kind of get him into that line of work. His hope is that by being the sort of tough-minded voice of reform in these editorials will then get attention. There is in Washington, the seat of power, and will probably become, you know, the next Senator Adams or Congressman Adams. And that doesn't happen, again, in part because he's not willing to kind of lobby for it. When he does have invitations to the White House, it makes it very clear that he regards these people, you know, Garfield, Arthur, is less than he is. You know, they didn't attend Harvard. They're not as bright as he is. So instead, he gets married. He marries a woman named Marion Hooper, who goes by the nickname of Clover, which is a childhood nickname. They get married in 1872, and rather to the family's surprise. Now, they get married also when his parents are over there in Switzerland at the Geneva arbitration. So of his family, only Charles Francis is actually there. And she's in her late 20s, which today would be nothing at the time. She's already kind of creeping up on spinsterhood. And what I find interesting about that marriage is, in the same way that Charles Francis Jr. wants to marry Minnie as kind of a balance, Henry wants to marry himself. And Clover is very much like Henry. Kind of eccentric, a little shy, very artistic. Charles doesn't like her at all, his brother. Derides the marriage as being no kind of affair. And Henry is not a romantic. Again, they start dating. He decides very early on that they're going to get married. But he's not introduced Clover to most of his friends. So he finally writes to one friend and says, this kind of really bizarre letter, and says, well, I'm going to marry her, and I think you'll like her. She's not plain, but she's not beautiful. And he goes down, here's a list of flaws. She kind of talks too much. Her Greek and her Latin a little bit on the weak side. Her clothing is a little strange. He says to his friend, though, we can fix that. So even for an Adams, Henry makes for kind of a rotten lover. It's just kind of a letter that would have you sort of running away. And Clover apparently is not a great beauty, but we don't actually really know what she looks like because she's so concerned about her appearance, probably because Henry says things like that to her. It's hard to get a photograph of her looking straight on at the camera. And the one I have in the book, she has this sort of big kind of floppy hat. She's holding a dog looking down. Well, you see her on a horse from 100 feet away. So in a day when elegant women, moneyed women, have wonderful paintings done, she does nothing like that. And they seem to have this kind of affectionate marriage. They travel throughout Europe, and at one odd moment, Charles Francis actually is in Europe on business. And he calls on them, and he writes home to his brother, John Quincy, and says, you know, I really just don't like her at all. She's just very odd, and Henry's already a little odd. She makes him kind of even odder. So the family never gets behind her. And she finally does meet the folks, Charles Francis Sr. and Abby. they don't like her at all. And there's actually kind of a funny in a sad way photograph of the book that we thought about using briefly as the cover. And they're at the old house in Quincy, and the door's open behind them. They're on the other side of the door, sitting on the front porch. And the door is open, so it would be kind of welcoming. It's dark inside, and they're both glaring. And she took the photograph standing on the ground below, so they're sort of glaring down at her, which is probably the way they almost always kind of looked at poor Clover. So living in Washington, and they're building this house. And then he becomes friends with this young woman, who is the niece of the General Sherman. She's Elizabeth Sherman Cameron. She's married to a senator who's much older than she is. Apparently not a very happy relationship. And Henry and all of his friends don't like the husband. But she's gorgeous. And the painting she has done of herself, she's beautiful. They all mention when she walks into the party, everyone just turns. She's also just the life of the party. She's gregarious. She's witty. She's charming. And Clover has to know that Henry is really smitten. Goes by Lizzie, with Lizzie. And tries to kind of befriend Lizzie. And so kind of the final moment comes. Clover is a great photographer. That's sort of her hobby. Takes these amazing shots. And she takes one of George Bancroft, the American historian. Really perfect shot, black and white, of course. He's holding a cigar, and this book's sort of wafting up over one shoulder, and he's got a book in hand. So the Atlantic Magazine is going to do a piece on Bancroft, who's sort of a rival historian for Henry. And they want to buy this photograph and run it in the magazine. And Henry says to Clover, you know, we're Adamses. You know, we don't sell things. It's fine if you want to have a hobby and take pictures, but actually selling them to a magazine is kind of beneath what we do. And then one Sunday he breaks a tooth and he goes to the dentist. And while he's gone, she drinks photography fluid. Probably took about 45 minutes to die. She was 42 years old. And she left behind sort of a bracelet, and she left it to Lizzie. So that there's all kinds of things in that sort of sad story that Dr. Freud probably would have liked. And so Henry comes home from the dentist, and there she is, dead, lying on the floor. So when Henry wrote his memoirs, which is an unusual kind of autobiography, The Education of Henry Adams, he never once mentions that he was married or had a wife or that she committed suicide. He doesn't talk about her really ever after that, just kind of banishes her memory from his life. So a really sad and awful story.
How and why did the Panic of 1893 and the deaths of children contribute to the untimely demise of John Quincy Jr., as well as exacerbate Henry's anti-Semitism and his growing disdain for Brooks? Also, if you can, please provide examples of Charles Francis Jr.'s public ideology of racialized anti-imperialism abroad and his embrace of the Confederate lost cause in defense of Robert E. Lee.
The last decade of the fourth generation is a fairly depressing story. John Quincy II keeps running for local office, the governor, state house, state senate, always has a Democrat, always loses in what then was a firmly Republican state. And he also lost two children within days of each other back in 1876, John Quincy III and Frances, known as Fanny. And it never really was the same after that. He was kind of a broken person, and that's you know, in itself, a sad, understandable story. He lived on until 1894, but he was just never quite the same after that, and drank heavily. Charles Francis, after being forced out of the road in 1890, developed this kind of very strange fondness for things Confederate. He began to write essays and give speeches on Robert Lee. He became an advocate of having a Lee statue in Washington, D.C., and here we are today debating the fate of Confederate statues across the South. He's talking now about having a Lee statue in Washington, D.C., and starts giving this kind of standard talk, which he has published as a pamphlet, gives it at William Emory College, does it in Chicago as well, not just in the South. He becomes very, very popular in the South, and the president of William and Mary at that point is a descendant of John Tyler. And famously says, if this Adams would run again, we'd be thrilled to have here in Virginia a third Adams in the White House. He meets Lee's elderly, never married daughter, who just praises his speech. And again, you know, it's he's not the only Republican to turn against Reconstruction reforms, to think that the Congress went too far. But it's one thing you know, to criticize, as again, many moderates did, Congress, you know, using the powers of the Constitution, clamping down on the White South. You know, praising Robert Lee was kind of a bit over the top. And even Henry never really got that. And even as Henry remained friends with Rooney Lee after the war, Henry always regarded basically all the Lees as being second-rate men. And so Henry writes to Charles Francis and says, I don't understand your fondness for these guys. But he's lies all across the South, giving this kind of standard speech. And that's kind of his retirement years. And again, openly racist. One of the strangest letters he writes to Henry when he's invited back to speak in Virginia. And he says, well, here I am back in Virginia. He has some friends, Negro. And of course, that's not the word he's using. Like he's just sort of dropping it in like a comma. And he also then becomes an anti-imperialist. But this is, of course, the decade of the Spanish-American War in the Philippines. But for racist reasons. So you've got reformers like Twain arguing that holding on to the Philippines as a colony is fundamentally anti-American. Adams is part of that group that argues the danger of imperialism is that it brings too many people who are dark-skinned into the Republic. So late in life, he travels to Cuba. He's just quite convinced that people who are not white are simply incapable of self-government. And so his concern is that, you know, if the U.S. doesn't just throw the Spanish out, but then does annex Cuba or annexes the Philippines, then are you bringing in Filipino senators down the road who would be Catholic and darker skinned? So he is anti-imperial, but for kind of very, very conservative, racialist kind of view. The youngest brother who I talk about a little bit in the book, not so much yet today, is Peter Brooks, who's far and away the baby of the family. And Peter decides he's going to be also the historian of the family. And of course, by this point, Henry's become a very famous novelist and very famous historian. And I'll give Henry this. I mean, Henry almost sort of really invents the craft of writing American history in the late 19th century. At a time when history is very impressionistic, Henry is a go-to the archives kind of guy. He goes to Europe to look at Spanish, French, British archives, you know, heavily documented. And by comparison, Preston, writes, he's kind of a pioneer in looking at how the economy changes the course of human history. But data doesn't seem to matter to him very much. And so his books get terrible reviews because they're just the things that are spectacularly wrong. The Huns invading Europe, he's off by hundreds of years. And at one point, all the boys are sort of estranged from each other. Charles doesn't like Henry. Henry doesn't like Brooks. And Brooks says to Henry, you know, why are you so fetishizing data? I mean, that's not really the point behind history. And so they become sort of very oddly competitive in their old age. And at one point, Brooks takes it into his head to write a biography of their grandfather, John Quincy. And he sends it to Henry, asking for his name. He writes back about 70 legal pages explaining why it's bad. But mostly he says it's because it's too nice to John Quincy. He says, you know, actually, he was terrifying as a grandfather. And I just think he was such a mean-spirited person, even though he was a good anti-slavery congressman. And so Brooks is so horrified by older brother Henry's views of his scholarship, he never publishes it. Then Charles Francis, who never liked his father, then writes the first ever biography of Charles Francis Sr. But it's kind of a classic Life and Times. It's the public man, not the private man, because again, later in life, Charles Francis is still telling people he just didn't like his father. So they all end up simply estranged from each other, which is really quite sad. Charles Francis and John Quincy are close, but that's kind of it for the family.
So what was the public's and the Adams family's receptions of the 1907 education of Henry Adams? And what were the ultimate fates of the three brothers?
Well, of course, when today Education of is remembered as a great work of fascinating autobiography. I mean, it's an untraditional work in that Henry refers to himself in the third person. So he'll say the boy Henry as opposed to I, you know, that kind of thing. It was only published for a handful of friends. So he had like 100 copies printed, sent to friends. So of course, after he dies, then it wins the Pulitzer Prize for autobiography, but for history. But at the time, it's simply being circulated among a few friends. And the way the brothers receive it tells you a lot about them. So if you, I had to go back and I'd not read it actually since college. I had to go back and reread it. It's kind of two parts to it. One simply is a pretty straightforward autobiography of here's what life was like as a child, here what was happening when I was with Dad in England. And the second part is much more philosophical. And so Charles Jr. wrote and said, well, you know, I'd love the first part. And we have the same kind of memories. We both loved Quincy, both hated the house on Beacon Hill. I think you were kind of too nice, Dad, and too hard on Mom. But otherwise, you know, Charles liked the first part. Brooks wrote back and said, you know, the first part just bored me out of my mind. Is the second part, the larger philosophical part, the kind of larger reflections on the world as it is, that's the part that Brooks liked more. Privately, Charles said that it was very silly, quote unquote, very silly as a book. And then about the same time, wrote his autobiography, which he simply mailed to the Mass Historical and said, well, here it is. Take it or not, I don't really care. So they did publish it with an introduction by Henry Cabot Lodge. So they're always, you know, that kind of competition. So if Henry's going to do a book about his life, then Charles is going to do one too. But it'll be different. It'll be more conventional, less kind of philosophical. So you know, even late in life, they're still kind of trying to elbow each other aside. Brooks does appreciate the mastery of Henry's work. Henry writes 8 volumes on history of Jefferson and Madison, still in print, incidentally. I'm still just an amazing, amazing work of scholarship. And for an Adams, very, very balanced when it comes to kind of the old rivalry between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. So they all kind of appreciate that. They mostly live on into the 20th century. John Quincy II doesn't. He dies in 1894. And again, he's been essentially broken since the death of his young children. Charles lives on until 1915, still extolling the virtues of the Confederacy. He dies right before Henry. And Henry writes a letter. He's still friendly with Lizzie. And Henry writes to Lizzie and says, well, Charles and I were in a race for the grave, and Charles won. So Henry lived until 1918. There was also, by the way, a boy, a younger sibling named Arthur Adams, who died at the age of 5 back in 1846. So slightly younger than Henry, but died as a child. And then Mary Gardner, who is the younger sister, it was actually kind of the one nice person in the fourth generation. And of course, Mom, Abby, her plan for Mary is that Mary will be the lifetime companion. And always be there to care for her late in life. And you know, that's kind of traditional for that period and that kind of class status. You always have like the one daughter who stays behind to kind of help you in your old age. And actually very late in life, Mary falls in love with a kinsman, a doctor named Quincy, and becomes Mary Gardner Adams Quincy. And Charles Francis Sr. is thrilled to give her away. And Abby is just very, very upset that her daughter is leaving and moving, by the way, like 5 miles down the road, not very far. Brooks is the last to go, but of course he's the youngest. He makes it until 1927. Still writing these kind of very sad and odd pieces. I would not call him a fascist, but of course Mussolini comes to power in 22. And Brooks does say some rather kind things toward the kind of trend to the right in Europe. He also marries late in life and becomes kind of a physical wreck. Can't keep a nurse, and probably because he drinks too much and keeps a loaded pistol on a side table. So he terrifies the nurses. They're always quitting. So he finally passes away. But he says something right before he dies that I found amazing. He's reflecting on his family's decline. And he basically pegs John Quincy I as being the source of this kind of discontent. And he says that of this growth in pessimism, my grandfather was the main figure. But then he says, not Henry or me, we are appendages only. And he says, no one in this fourth generation will ever be remembered. And to a certain extent, he's not that wrong, apart from Henry, who still remains viable in literary studies and American studies and history. But look, we're appendages only, these kind of tattered remnants of a one great family. So Brooks recognizes, yeah, the family is not close to being what it was in earlier generations, but they all blame the grandfather, which is interesting because he was just, they think, not very nice.
It is interesting. So what's next for you? Are you working on any new projects? Are you going on vacation?
A little bit of both. But again, to the extent that all of my books lead to the next, I mean, part because I found the Adamses to be just so unpleasant. A guy has popped up in several of my books. It's Thomas Wentworth Higginson. he always has kind of cameos, and he's also a 19th century feminist. So any book on Elizabeth Cady Stanton, there he is. I mean, he also leads black troops in battle. He's a Boston Brahmin, and the first South Carolina infantry is a contraband unit, and he becomes the second colonel of that operation. Is a reformer, feminist. He's a minister in Massachusetts, out near Worcester. One quick story: when Lucy Stone, the feminist, gets married, she refuses to have the term "obey" as part of the wedding vow. And she can't find a minister anywhere in Boston who will leave the word out. And so she's heard about this guy, Higginson, out there in Worcester, and writes him and says, "Will you come marry me and leave that word out?" It's like, "I'm on the train." So if there's a cause, he's in. He's out there with Kansas with John Brown. He's one of the Secret Six. So he's a financial benefactor of Brown. Lifelong health aficionado. Late in life, he still has chin-up bars and parallel bars and lifting weights. He's a very big guy, about 6'2", 6'3". Writes 487 books. He makes a lot of money with a child's history of the U.S., which after his death in 1911, the Daughters of the Confederacy worked very hard on banning because it's anti-slavery, anti-Southern. That's my next project is a book on Higginson. There's two books going back to the 60s. Not great. Neither one have footnotes. And I find him just absolutely fascinating. So that's my next project.
Well, we hope you remember New Books in History for that project.
I said, I'm thrilled to be on. I really appreciate it.
So the book is Heirs of an Odder Name, The Decline of the Adams Family and the Rise of Modern America, published earlier this year by Basic Books. On behalf of Professor Edgerton, as well as New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network, this is Ryan Tripp signing off. Please tune in next time.